Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of July 9th, 2015. Today, we're happy to be joined by our frequent guest, the prolific commentator, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Good. How are you doing?
Very well. Very well. It's another summer evening here, mid-July in New England. It's wonderful, right?
Mm-hmm.
So tell me, this past week, well, as a preface, there is an organization that started here in Boston known as the Union of Concerned Scientists. It has a long and storied history of having scientists speak on important issues of the day. And for many years, it was primarily concerned with nuclear weapons. Right? That's mm-hmm. what the Union of Concerned Scientists was focused on. But over the last couple decades, UCS has become more and more concerned with climate change. And so they released a big report this week, right, DR? Tell me, what did the Union of Concerned Scientists, or the UCS, tell us?
It was a report called the Climate Deception Dossier, which was released on July the 8th, and it exposed the long, long history of fossil fuel companies knowing about the severe risks of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, and yet continuing to finance disinformation campaigns. The critical finding of this new report is that in 1981, scientists working for ExxonMobil informed ExxonMobil, then known as Exxon, that they could not move forward with certain fossil fuel development projects because of the risks of CO2 that would be emitted. And one of these scientists was apparently involved, later went on to be involved in an entity known as the Global Climate Coalition, which is a group of fossil fuel companies and car manufacturers that was formed in the late 1980s to basically essentially kill off the International Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and make sure that governments did not move forward on doing anything to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And the controversy, as has been indicated in all the reports on this report, is that 7 years before James Hansen went to the U.S. Senate to inform people of those severe risks, the fossil fuel industry itself recognized that this was a severe risk and that they kept on
and
financing
course,
this.
James Hansen was 1986, right? That he appeared
in 88. Although, ironically enough, in August of 1981, Hansen released a comprehensive report about the risks right around the time that Exxon was saying, yes, we recognize the problem. And of course, you may remember there was a comprehensive 1979 report by the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, I believe it was, is saying that there are some severe risks that we're facing. In fact, it's going to be, I believe, 36 years this month that report was released. So
and the important point about this UCS documentation is the fact that the fossil fuel companies knew from the beginning, from the 1970s, mm-hmm. that there was a
yes.
real and present danger of burning fossil fuels, right? And mm-hmm. so all the protestations to the contrary, notwithstanding, internally, they had documents, and they're all smart guys. They're geologists. Mm-hmm. There's nobody stupid at Exxon that this was a problem, right?
In fact, if I remember correctly, the books Private Empire by Stephen Call about ExxonMobil, I think they noted in that book that there was that ExxonMobil had recognized the risks of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases as early as the 1960s. So you're talking about at least two generations of deception on the part of these organizations.
So tell me, is there, so the UCS has conclusively proven that the people in the fossil fuel industry are liars and dissemblers, mm-hmm. right? So mm-hmm. fine, is there any consequence to it? Does it change politics at all? I mean, what falls out of knowing this?
Well, as was noted on the Huffington Post website, this ties into recent statements by Rhode Island Senator Sheldon Whitehouse suggesting that the fossil fuel industry should be held accountable under the Racketeer Influence and Corrupt Organization Act, the RICO Act, for knowingly peddling false information about their product. And Sheldon Whitehouse got into a lot of controversy from climate change deniers about this proposal. But according to the Huffington Post, according to Elliot Nagrin of the Union of Concerned Scientists, writing for the Huffington Post, this report has proven that everything that Sheldon Whitehouse has said was true, that the fossil fuel industry did the exact same thing the tobacco industry did about knowingly lying about the risks of their product. And just as the tobacco industry was held accountable under the RICO statutes, the fossil fuel industry ought to be held to the same account.
Remind me, was the tobacco industry, and of course that probably means what the big seven tobacco companies, they mm-hmm. were prosecuted under RICO?
As Elliot Nagrin notes that in 2006, a federal district court ruled that the tobacco industry's deceptive campaign to maximize its profits by hoodwinking the public amounted to a racketeering enterprise, unquote. And Sheldon Whitehouse also made the point that, you know, the various lawsuits and the various legal actions taken against the fossil fuel industry, many of those lawsuits and many of those legal actions were predicated on the idea that the fossil fuel industry was knowingly lying to the public about what they were doing.
Well, I mean, of course, the tobacco industry is the great model that everyone sort of understands and has lived with for mm-hmm. a deceptive industry, and it's pretty clear that the oil industry seems to be following in that playbook, right?
Definitely, definitely. And I think it was Bill McKibben that noted on Twitter on July the 8th that 16 years after Exxon said, hey, we recognize the risk of global warming, the then head of Exxon in 1997 declared that the planet was cooling. So basically it just shows you the level of the deception going on.
Well, okay. So now we know that Exxon is a bunch of bad actors, right?
And knowing is half the battle, and it goes back to this controversy, because as you know, there's been lots of discussion about ExxonMobil's statements on their website saying that the best way to handle the issue of greenhouse gas emissions is through a revenue neutral carbon tax, mm-hmm. and how sad it is that on the one hand ExxonMobil is saying that on their website, but on the other hand, you know, you've had all these statements from ExxonMobil executives over the years downplaying the risks of CO2, or basically saying we can just adapt. It's like this sort of corporate dissociative identity disorder, basically, on the part of Exxon.
Speaking of big oil companies doing crazy things, I understand the following has happened. I mean, D.I., mm-hmm. you and I have spoken many times about the Royal Dutch Shell exploration in the Chukchi Sea, right? This is the Kayaktivist guys with the big oil drilling rig that sailed out of Seattle 2 or 3 weeks ago to mm-hmm. take advantage of the summertime melt up in the Arctic to do some drilling to find some more fossil fuels up there. Well, it turns mm-hmm. out that, lo and behold, and at the time, of course, Barack Obama, at least I, was quite angry with Barack Obama for letting this thing go forward mm-hmm. and why he hadn't put a stop to it somehow. I guess there are limitations to what he is able to do. But it turns out that actually some climate activists got together and reviewed all the licenses and whatnot and found out that there's a rule that these big drilling exploration rigs cannot drill two wells within something like 15 miles of each other, right? Because mm-hmm. it upsets the polar bears and the seals and whatnot. And mm-hmm. the two wells that Royal Dutch Shell were going to drill were 9 miles away from each other. So all of a sudden, Royal Dutch Shell has to hold up, review all those plans, and presumably can only proceed with one of the two drilling operations because the other one's in violation of the law. And, of course, the Obama administration, once they – I don't know why they didn't pick up on this before, but I guess once mm-hmm. they saw it, in fact, told Royal Dutch Shell they had to abide by that, which mm-hmm. shows you that maybe there's a little bit of hope in the Bureau of Mines there, or maybe it's a good thing that people have been complaining about it, sort of awakened made the Obama administration look for an opportunity to do something. So the mm-hmm. Chukchi Sea thing is not over, it's that big yellow drilling platform is still floating around somewhere off Alaska, but it's been somewhat legally limited to what it can do, and that can only be good for climate hawks, right?
Exactly, and we note again the irony, as with Exxon. Royal Dutch Shell recently co-wrote that letter to the UN saying we want an international price on carbon. We recognize the risk of climate change, and at the same time they are endeavoring to try to worsen the impacts of climate change by continuing to drill instead of trying to, you know, take their massive profits and redirect them towards investment in clean energy.
I agree. And just not to go too far off the ranch here, but I noted that the Episcopal Church is going to divest from fossil fuels, right? They took a vote.
Yes.
Did you see that headline? I mean, speaking of finding fuel, the only way, I mean, if you imagine the oil companies as some sort of psychotic zombie that just needs to accumulate value, right? And so they're out drilling for these things. The only way to stop them is through things like divestment and shame. And God knows the Episcopal Church can do that, right?
Exactly, and the Episcopal Church is basically saying that if we don't move away from fossil fuels, future generations won't have a prayer.
I got to hand it to you, DR. You do have a way of coming up with a phrase in the spur of the moment. So the last topic that I was thinking would be interesting to touch on is the following, and again, it's somewhat legalistic, and it has to do with oceans. Everyone's heard of climate change, and many people, but not all people, have heard of climate change's evil twin, which turns out to be ocean acidification. Now, what does that mean? Well, for the people, if you've been following the climate, the path of carbon, done any kind of looking at it, or if you haven't, let me tell you that something like two-thirds of the carbon dioxide that comes out of your tailpipe actually ends up in the ocean. It's absorbed by the ocean. And only one-third is in the air. So even though we've got this big rise in the carbon dioxide level in the air, there's twice as much as gone into the ocean. And the thing about carbon dioxide, when it goes into water, it makes the water more acidic, right? And you can... you can go to your refrigerator now, take out a bottle of Polar Seltzer, right, which is charged with carbon dioxide, and that's got a more acidic taste to it, right? That's what the CO2 does in any kind of water. It makes it more acidic. Problem with being more acidic is that the acid in the water erodes the seashells. So all of the animals in the ocean that have a shell, from clams and quahogs to, you know, everything else, their shells get thinner and are destroyed. And then, of course, the food chain could collapse, et cetera, et cetera. It's a terrible prospect. Anyway, a group of activists have petitioned. So in the United States, a group of activists recognizing the fact that this is actually toxins in the water that have been introduced into the water through the carbon dioxide. They go to the EPA and they ask the EPA to take responsibility under something called the Toxic Substances Control Act. The Toxic Substance Control Act, right? Which is basically has to do with, you know, pouring poisons in the river, like the guys in Tennessee where they let all the licorice-smelling coal stuff go into the river a year ago, January or so. I mean, the EPA has responsibility to do that. If you recognize that carbon dioxide is creating the same sort of toxins in the water, under the same law, you can manage carbon dioxide. And what they were saying is that what's really cool about this approach is that it's not just prospective emissions that might happen in the future, but you have to, under this law, do mitigation, which is to go back and do some sort of carbon sequestration. And it just gives the EPA a new set of tools to try and manage carbon. I mean, we're a long, long way from actually having that become a real regulation, but it's a very intriguing idea that the CO2 that we emit goes into the ocean and makes the oceans toxic. All of a sudden, that falls under an existing law that can be used as a mechanism for controlling carbon. I hope that was confusing enough for everybody.
And there's a great piece by Ben Adler on Grist about this on the 8th, and reading it on July the 8th, and reading it, it brings to mind, and he mentions in the final paragraph the whole fight about trying to regulate carbon dioxide as an air pollutant, and how it was originally in 1998 that there was discussion within the EPA about the prospect of doing so. A petition was filed in 1999. And it wasn't until 2007 that the U.S. Supreme Court said, yes, the EPA can regulate carbon dioxide as an air pollutant. And it wasn't really until 2009 that the EPA signaled that it was going to go ahead and do so. So if you think about it, that was an 11-year fight. Could this fight to have CO2 regulate as a toxic substance, could that fight take a longer period of time, or could it potentially take a shorter period of time with all the activism that's been going on this issue, which is obviously much more intense than it was in the late 1990s and early to mid-2000s?
I mean, it's an interesting thing, because I think we touched on this a couple weeks ago, how the court case in Holland and the court case on the West Coast, where the teenagers sued the state of Washington, show these tiny incremental legal challenges that start to win. And I saw a blog earlier today comparing all of this this incremental legal advance somewhat with, of course, not an exact analogy, but somewhat with the marriage equality, you know, slowly snowballing. You know, I think you've said it, DR, you keep losing until you start to win, right?
Exactly.
You just keep
exactly.
plugging away, and then pretty soon, if the legal the legal wins come, huh?
And then, as to quote President Obama, justice comes like a thunderbolt.
It seems like it was sudden, right? But it's actually
exactly.
many years of preparation. Well, DR, we'll have to leave it there. Interesting discussion. To all of everyone out there in podcast land, you can check out the links to most of what we've said here on the blog. It's massclimateaction.wordpress.com. You can leave us a comment. You can send us an email, comment@massclimateaction.net. You can, of course, find us on Facebook, @massclimateaction. You can share us. You can like us. You can listen to us if you click through the blog. You can listen to us directly on your smartphone using Stitcher. You can find us on iTunes by searching for Massachusetts Climate Action. So we'll close where we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it is our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the United States put a price on carbon. Thank you very much for being here, DR.
Thanks.
And thanks to everyone for listening. We'll see you all next week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us. And until next time, be green.
Very cool. Ha 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 ha.